Hello.
Hey.
Welcome to Rosé and DNA. I'm Deanna.
And I'm Renee. And we're two professionals working in the field of genetics.
So for lucky number 13, we have Dr. Namrata Sengupta on our show today. We are so excited to be speaking with her. She is a scientist, a science communicator, most importantly, career coach and advocate for equity in health and STEM. Going back a little bit to her education, she got her BS in chemistry from the University of Calcutta, her MS in biotechnology from Bangalore University, and then PhD in environmental toxicology from Clemson University. And since then, is now the Associate Director of Scientific Public Engagement in the Broad Discovery Center at the Broad Institute of MIT and Harvard. And then if that weren't enough, she is also a board member of Asian Women for Health, a volunteer as a career coach and mentor for early career professionals, and gives invited talks to schools, higher ed, and all of the above to inspire young folks to get into STEM and learn all about, you know, the different careers that they can have. So really kind of the perfect guest for Rosé and DNA, and we are just so excited to dive into all of this. So thank you for being here.
Absolutely. It's my pleasure. Thank you for the invitation.
So, of course, the name of our podcast is Rosé and DNA, and since it's officially happy hour time, it's 5 o'clock, we all are having a glass of wine today, I think. So maybe we could just go around and say what we're having today. What about you, Renee?
I am drinking. So I just ran out in the middle of the day to the wine store to grab something because I didn't like what we had on our shelves. And when I do that, I really just go by the look of the bottle. So I am drinking a Cabernet Sauvignon and Merlot, so a red blend of sorts. It is, from Chile. And the name of it is Telmo and Ruth. And it actually has this really cute little story on the back that I thought was kind of funny, so I figured I'd read it. So, a gallant man, Telmo, had his pride melted away as Ruth, a pure beauty, looked him in the eyes. A flash of heat struck him, accelerating his heart, while a thousand butterflies dance in her womb, which made me LOL, provoking a sensation of excitement and desire. "This is love," she whispered in his ear, a confession that tied their souls together for all eternity. I just thought that was like the funniest thing on the back of it, especially the the thousand butterflies dancing in her womb, because that is the only way, as we know, a woman can tell she is in love. So that is what I'm drinking today. A nice Chilean red blend. How about you, Deanna?
Well, I don't think I have as fun of a story on my wine, but I am drinking a Cabernet Sauvignon from Longevity, and it's a vineyard out in Livermore, California. So I'm just wishing that I was out there in the sunny weather right now because it's so cold in Boston. And I picked this one because I'm currently in the Boston area and I'm not here that often. So I can finally order from Urban Grape, which is our staple wine store here in Boston. It's in the South End. And I was looking really just for like a medium body red blend. And the cool thing about Urban Grape is that they actually categorize their wines by body. So it's not like by the varietal or like the region. So you can kind of say, do I want like a really light wine or like a full body wine? And so, yeah, I usually go for like a medium body. And this one is fun. When it got delivered, I did not know this, but it's a fun little twist cork bottle. So you don't even have to use a wine opener, which is ideal. Yeah, I'm excited.
And our guest of honor.
So I'm drinking this wine, which is from a winery in California. The winery is Dark Horse. And the wine is called Buttery Chardonnay. I just also thought Chardonnay kind of rhymes with DNA. And I didn't pick a rosé. Chardonnay is also one of my favorite wines in general. All my graduate school friends who will be listening to this podcast, they would have been disappointed if I wasn't drinking Chardonnay.
Well, now that we've finished the important part, we can move on to some questions that we have for you. And something that we always do with our guests is know, start by going back to, you know, where you grew up and dig down to your roots. So can you tell us a little bit about, you know, where you're from and you know, what your childhood was like? What did you like doing as a kid?
That's such a great question. Thank you. And I haven't like heard that question in such a long time. No one's asked me that question in a long time. So it was like a walk down the memory lane, thinking about childhood, middle school, high school. Just to kind of begin with, okay, I'm originally from India. I grew up in Kolkata, which is on the eastern part of India. I was born there. I lived there, grew up there up until college. And only after finishing college, I moved to Bangalore, where I did my master's and worked at a nonprofit before I moved to the US for PhD. But going back to childhood, I was just trying to think of using a comparison. And I think as a child, if you could imagine, I was kind of like the Hermione Granger who would raise her hand for everything except like sports or Quidditch in that case. I think like leadership always like kind of came naturally to me. Even when I was like 7 or 8 years old, I was always the class monitor. And up until like high school, I went on to become the school head girl. So that was just something I remember. So, you know, about formative experiences all from elementary up until high school. Thinking about academics, I remember I loved science, especially math and biology. Those were two of my really favorite subjects. But besides science, I loved art. I loved public speaking. I did a lot of spoken word poetry. And then I did a lot of creative writing. I loved writing. And some of my friends in school and I, we used to write, direct, and act in like plays. We would just like come up with our own little skits and just act in front of our, put up a show in front of our teachers and friends. So sometimes when I reflect about all those years, I think of it as everything I enjoyed and appreciated while growing up. In a way, so many elements of that culminated into a career path later in life. At that time, like I think a 12-year-old me would have never ever thought that one day I could use everything I like, academic or non-academic, into like a real, like legit career path. I also grew up being surrounded by very strong female like role models. My mom, my sister, my teachers. I would also say that, however, irrespective of that, I didn't have any immediate family member who was in the sciences. So I had to figure out a lot of stuff on my own growing up related to higher studies or career, things like that. I was the first person in my family to get a degree, a bachelor's degree in a science field. I was also the first person in my family and extended family to go on to get like graduate and PhD degrees or even like move to another country for higher studies. So I just feel like a lot of it was being the first person in the family and like figuring those things out as I went along with no like playbook for it or no like immediate guidance, except the fact that, you know, I was surrounded by very, very supportive family members and teachers and like the community. So those are all the reflections I have about growing up.
And can you say more about your process for deciding to do a PhD in the US? Because I imagine that to some extent you probably could have done, you know, public outreach and public, you know, engagement work without a PhD to some extent. But was it that you were interested in, you know, doing more scientific research at the same time? Or yeah, what was that driving factor?
Yeah, so I think like when I was in college, after I figured out, okay, I'm not going into medical school, I made up my mind that I was going to, you know, go for a career path that leads me to get trained as a scientist. So right after college, I also like, I was majoring in chemistry for undergrad, and I kind of moved for my master's, I moved to biotech because I wanted to get into something applied, which will get me closer towards, you know, applying for a PhD program. And I, at that time, thought that my PhD will be like something in biotech or something in like protein chemistry, like mm-hmm. at the intersection of biology and chemistry. But right around that time when I was doing my master's program, I got exposed to like certain areas of work in environmental sciences and environmental biotech and public health. And that really like gave me a moment to like pause. And that was a decision mm-hmm. that I had to take that, okay, right from my master's, I'm not getting into going into a PhD. I just want to like figure this. Like, I want to see mm-hmm. like, you know, why do I want like to choose just a biomedical general field, like without even actually focusing on why do I want to do my PhD in a specific field. So I took some time off and like worked, and that really helped shape like which kind of labs do I want to apply for my PhD. Mm-hmm. So it was like as if I knew I was going to apply for a PhD and I was going to become a scientist, but my work in public engagement and my work with nonprofits kind of informed the type of specialization I would go for. So it was a little bit like happening in parallel. And I, at that point of time, I did not even know that, you know, that kind of work was a really a career choice. There was no terminology around science communication, or there was no terminology. Sure. Nobody was saying that you could have a job like as a full-time public engagement with science. When I came into grad school, like right from my very first year, like, you know, I always had a very honest conversation with my PI that I was not going to go into like tenure track like that. I always like clarified with him that after I finished my, even in my interview for my PhD, like, you know, I had mentioned in my statement of purpose or in my interview that I want to possibly work for a nonprofit or for some like public health regulatory agency or a consulting group, like, which is very applied. So I always knew that besides having a very applied PhD program, I needed to have like very good communication, like skills to mm-hmm. go along with it, because I wanted like my expectations of being a scientist was to go and work in a very applied place where either regulations or like, you know, communication or like consulting is happening along with like the community. So it was a slightly longer version of trying to answer your question, but that was how my thinking was shaped.
And, you know, something that you've also written a lot about is that being in academia or going through a PhD program and then, you know, choosing a path that's not necessarily a tenure track position is actually the norm. You know, it's pretty common for people to be, you know, choosing a path outside of academia. And you've also written about how, you know, you felt that you've had two identities, one as a scientist, but also as a science communicator. So can you talk more about the value that you see of scientists having, you know, finding different paths, being in different rooms?
Yeah, thank you. I think a lot about this aspect of you know, science identity, especially because, you know, I still, even after so many years since I've graduated, like I still almost always receive this question, why did you leave academia, or why did you, you know, leave the bench? So it's almost feels like that sometimes, you know, you're having to like explain yourself still. So that's why I proactively mm-hmm. started communicating more about it, you know, wrote in my like the opinion piece that you're referring to. So the way I like to discuss this, you know, with my friends or colleagues or any, you know, a forum like this is, I think we often tend to see science and society as two separate streams or fields, if you could say. But science and society are so really like closely tied to each other. Like science impacts society and society impacts science. So if we keep that framing in mind, then shouldn't we have scientists represented in various aspects of our society? And that's kind of the reason why many times in like, you know, conversations and interviews, I've always said that that's the basic reason why I'm advocating for the idea that we need more scientists in boardrooms, in newsrooms, in government offices, in community organizations. Like if we could shift our perception of seeing mm-hmm. scientists associated with just academia, like places of research and labs, to seeing them, like where places, to seeing scientists mm-hmm. where decisions are being made, like places where decisions are being made and decisions are being conveyed, places where scientists could show up with critical thinking, with evidence-based decision-making, with data-driven, data-driven work. Like, we could make a really, you know, big impact in those places and spaces, I would say. So, yeah. And there couldn't be a better time than to give the example that we have seen repeatedly during the last 2 years, during the global pandemic, like why scientists were needed at every level. Like, you know, I wish, like, even at the local, like, community level and at various decision-making level, like, scientists always were a part of the conversation. In some places, they've done it better than the others. And we are still, like, you know, there's a big challenge lying ahead of all of us. And that is, you know, the conversation around climate change. And we still could do a lot about, like, having those conversations, bringing in scientists into places to really lead that work and be thought partners. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, if to my friends and colleagues and others who are listening to this podcast, like, I'm inviting more and more of them to, like, you know, raise their hand, be a part of boards, be a part of commissions, volunteer in places, even if that's not a part of your full-time job. That's how I like to think about it. I also often like to explain it to, you know, my friends and family about the training as a scientist. Like, people go to law school, get trained to be a lawyer, and that's like a, you know, professional training. People go to business school, people go to, like, I would say medical school, and, you know, it's a training. So when you, as a scientist, you invest 5 years in a PhD or 2 years in a master's, you are going through a professional training, and the skill sets you come out with through those programs, whether it's your master's or it's your PhD, like, those skill sets, like, I could use my example, the kind of skill sets I gained and why I'm mm-hmm. using those skill sets from my PhD in my job, which it's not in a bench science-based job. It's communicating to the public about science. But I think, like, my experience as a graduate student researcher, like, spending 5 years on a long project taught me skills around project management. Every year, I mentored and advised several undergraduate, high school, and master's students in the lab. So it taught me the values and skills of mentoring. I learned communicating complex pieces of information in a very, you know, systematic way to various audiences, right? Like, of course, the focus was a lot on scientific audiences, but still, like, complexing and translating information through, like, either verbal presentation or through writing. These are skills that are transferable in so many ways. Mm-hmm. Teaching, like, during the 5 years in grad school, I taught for 5 years as a TA, like a teaching assistant. That's a big, like, skill set when you kind of think of it. I'm not a professor or a teacher now, but that the skills are transferable in, like, communicating, in learning to how to, like, work with different sets of people. And then you learn as a doctoral student to defend your work with evidence, with data, with research. And that is something, it's such a valuable skill, because after I stepped out of grad school and I have been in, like, a professional field, those skills of, like, you know, learning to pitch my idea, learning to defend my idea, you know, mm-hmm. learning to present my idea has always, like, become a key skill set that I use every day of my job. And then the 5 years of training as a PhD also teaches you, like, critical thinking, working in long-term projects, which has phases, and, you know, it has, you're expected to make progress along the way. And all of those things are very relatable, even in your job. Like, you know, you just, you are, many of us are working on long-term projects, which we are making progress with every passing month. And I think of such strong similarities with how, like, my doctoral training was, and what about those that I get to, like, live and breathe, like, every day in my job now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think you've made a great argument for how transferable all these skills are. Like, it really, I think people think that it's just, you know, this didactic, like, studying and just, like, you know, taking exams and, you know, just learning how smart you can be. But really, it's just so much more than that, that educational piece. And but also at the same time, it's kind of what you put into it, and what you aim to gain from it. But I guess to even take a step back a little bit, I feel like science communication or being a science communicator could probably mean a lot of different things. So, and I feel like actually even myself, like I didn't even realize kind of what you said before, that this was like a career, you know, that people could pursue. And so do you mind just kind of explaining what a, how you would explain what a science communicator operates in various roles?
Yeah. I'll start with my example when I have to explain my job to people who are outside of my network, immediate professional network. I try to introduce myself as I'm a scientist who helps other scientists speak to non-scientists. And in a way, that's like the gist of what a lot of science communicators do.
Yeah.
When I'd like to actually answer that question with a slight framing of when I coach graduate students, those who are interested in science communication as a career path, I always ask them these three questions at the beginning of a mentoring or a coaching session. And the three questions are very simple. Who do you want to communicate to? Why do you want to communicate? And the third is, how do you want to communicate? And those three things, the who, how, and why, are the basics of, like, I feel, any like science communication path. So the who is kind of really important because it defines your audience. I've often spoken to students who've said that I really want to inspire the next generation of scientists, or people have told me my research is very relatable for patients, and I really want to communicate to patients. So defining the who is the first step. And then the goal, like, why do you want to communicate? I think every good science communication project, science communication initiative starts with a great goal, because, like, you know, that defines your why. Like, what is the message? Why is this important? What are the stakes? And what do you want to get out of it? And the how is so personal, because it's like, there are so many times when I'll talk to somebody and then they'll say that, you know, I think like I really want to be a science communicator, but people have been very honest and told me that they don't like writing. And if I tell them like science communication is science writing, then that's a very narrow view of what science communication is. If you are a really good writer, then that's definitely key, but that's not the only way you know, science communication happens. So I try to like explain to anybody who's getting exposed to science communication as a field is like, the how you do science communication can vary, and we can choose our own paths. So right now, if I think of it, what you both are doing is like just a clear example of science communication. The medium you have chosen in a way is like, you know, audiovisual, you've chosen podcasts. So somebody who is who can aspire to be a really good podcast producer is also a science communicator. They are trying to help, you know, transfer complex information or perspectives to the community. So the how can vary. So science writing is a way of becoming a science communicator. Social media, like my first job out of grad school, when I worked at the Journal of Visualized Experiments, almost, you know, 30 to 40% of my role was running like global social media campaigns for the entire organization. So I did a lot of social media, you know, in graduate school on volunteering basis, and those skills like transferred to my first job. Visual design, there are people who are science illustrators or, you know, graphic designers, and they choose the medium of design and art to like communicate about science. So those are also science communicators, video producers, people who are really good at like, you know, producing science content through like through the format of videos. Like video producers are science communicators as well. And the other format is like a little broad, I would say outreach, teaching. Maybe people could think of some people like reach out to me and they say that they love like oral presentation. They don't like writing and they just love giving talks. And it's kind of sometimes hard to find a job opportunity where you're only talking. I always encourage them, like, please volunteer, at least start with volunteering. But there are roles, like, you know, it could be like, there are teaching opportunities, there are opportunities at museums, at science centers, at, or like, sometimes I try to ask people if they're really focused on that particular skill, and that's what they want to do full time. Think about career paths in industry, maybe, where, you know, those skill sets are very needed. Like, there are certain job opportunities in industry which people don't often think of as like traditional science communication roles, but, you know, content specialists, field application scientists, like, these are people who are communicating with the clients or really pitching about, like, you know, the product or explaining to people how this core like drug or scientific concept works. So those are also like science communication aligned fields. And that's, I also try to create awareness about, you know, job opportunities, not just in core science communication, but industry aligned roles as well. Some people want to write, but they want to write not for the general public, like non-specialists. They want to write for other scientists, or they want to write for other like collaborators and patients. And so technical writing is one field. Medical writing is one field. These are, you know, different forms of writing. But once you know which is the audience you want to communicate to and you know your skill sets, then you can kind of match those and think about a career path in science communication.
Well, thank you for going through all of that, because it's so helpful to know what the full scope is. And also, it's interesting because it's very much so a process. Like, it's very structured, and it seems like there's a formula in some ways. You know, thinking about the how and the why and who. And it's a skill. Like, it's not something you can just kind of approach without, you know, considering all of the pieces. And it might be a skill that's different than, you know, coding or pipetting, but those are important skills. And, you know, if you didn't go through that process, then what's the point of pipetting and doing the science if there's not someone to actually translate it to people that need to understand what it means? Yeah, I guess maybe a more controversial question, because I think sometimes we have seen this where in some rooms, being a science communicator, the person translating the science to other scientists or, you know, patients and so on, that's sometimes seen as like a soft skill, and it might not always be celebrated in some rooms. And so I'm wondering if you could elaborate more on, you know, what your thoughts might be around science communication as a skill that needs to be in every room. And if there's ever been times where you felt like you had to advocate for being in that room as a science communicator.
Yeah. Maybe I can just first give an example of something I do every year, which is aligned with what you're asking. So every fall, I train a group of 20 PhD students in Clemson University who are finalists of Clemson's annual 3-minute thesis competition. In 2014, I was the winner of Clemson's first ever 3-minute thesis competition. And now as an alum, I coach the finalists every year who go into the finals. So these are students who are coming from engineering, like, you know, arts and science and like different fields, business. And the idea is like they have to do a really good job in 3 minutes to explain their PhD thesis to a non-specialist audience. And that is wide, right? Like it could be professors, students, university staff, members of the public, potential, you know, people, hiring committees, like who are coming, who are getting industry partners, who are getting invited. And I always start like by trying to tell them that you have to go into this competition with a really good goal. And I give them the strategies around like 4 basic principles. That is, again, I'm going back to the same fundamental. Know your audience. That's the first thing I teach the students. And I do some exercises with them to like, how can they sharpen that? How do they know their audience better and what value that brings to them as a communicate or talking about their PhD. Then I give them examples of why having such a strong 3-minute like general pitch about their research, where all can that, like, what are the use cases, you know, having something like that ready. I teach them how to write a script for their 3-minute talk, which has like, you know, an intro. There is some story where you have the details of the research, which is not too much, because that's what most students struggle with. They get into the details. So I ask them to like strip the details, keep it very precise, and then add something about like, you know, every story has an arc where the story where it picks up drama. Like, of course, you don't have to dramatize your research, but like there is some kind of element where in your story, which like really raises the audience's interest. And then you kind of like summarize it. So I give them, like I train them on to build a script like that. And then I basically do a test with them to say like, do you think that are you using jargons in your talk? And I show them like 4 questions. If you've answered yes to any of these questions, yes, that's a jargon. I encourage them to de-jargonify the talk and why accessible language is important in communicating. So that's how, like, of course, that's a room full of students every fall that you're training who haven't like fully, some of them are really good communicators, but they are just trying to like finesse, you know, they need the finesse for the talk to compete in the finals. But these are all like super transferable skills, because if you think of it anywhere after you finish your PhD, like even if you're in academia, you're a PI, or even if you've gone on to industry and you're a scientist, or you're somewhere else, like, you know, you're pursuing a different career path, like you're often always the skills that you're using are writing, presenting, writing a lot of emails, responding to a lot of emails. Think about the time you spend in communicating for the rest of your career, attending meetings where you have to make your point and then collect people's opinions, collect people's feedback, and make changes to your ongoing plan. You have to learn how to, like, you know, make a direct, like if you're growing up in a career where like you start having reports, whether you're PI running a lab with like direct like graduate students and postdocs, or you're somebody who's running a team with like, you know, big industry opportunity with like 10 direct reports. In every place, you're also mentoring, you're like course correcting, you're giving people feedback. You're so it's all about like those other soft skills that you've gained along the way that you're using in your job as a scientist or a non-scientist after you graduate. So I would argue to say that I think soft skills should not be ignored. And I'm grateful to have the opportunity to train graduate students at some times in a setting, like let's say when I go to Clemson to train the students who are participating, like I'm glad I get an opportunity to tell them how relatable or transferable these things are later in their career. But I totally get your point. These are often seen as soft skills, and these are not like, you know, getting lab data, or this is not like running long experiments. All of those require a lot of planning, discipline, and several hours at lab. But what's the point if you're not able to communicate about that, if you're not able to condense that information, write clearly about it, write up a successful grant application, you know, whatever that is, like it is those soft skills that along with like your science, scientific training that needs to happen in parallel. And I still would say if you can take some courses that would improve your communication style, like provide your communication training. And I think it's a lot of it, we go into graduate school with the expectation that we want like our PI, our committee to provide us with all the advice we need, which is great. They're there for us for the scientific advice we need for our projects. But sometimes it is not within the scope of my PI to like provide me maybe writing mentorship or training or like, you know, oral presentation. Like I may need that extra push or extra training and extra like, you know, kind of skill building workshop from somewhere else. And it is okay to like, you know, go out for those opportunities, gather some of that. And it's a payoff. Like whether you decide to stay in academia, whether you go into industry or pursue any other job, like those have huge payoffs for the rest of your career, because one thing I've learned in since grad school, you have to really learn to write effective emails. Mm-hmm. And there was no training yeah. provided how to write a good email or how to condense mm-hmm. your information in an email. And that's something we are all doing.
Yeah, what's that about?
So
you're right. That should have been the first thing they teach you in grad school.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, it is so funny how like those things are so important, but they are kind of deprioritized in a lot of programs. And it sounds like you've done a lot, like you did a lot of work to prioritize it yourself. And I think the way that it is structured in a lot of academic settings is it kind of that onus is put on the student to really prioritize those things. But I think you just made a really good argument that it needs to be built into programs. I guess to switch gears a little bit, now that we have a better understanding of the scope of science communication, we would love to narrow in on what that means for you right now. So before working at the Broad, you had worked as a science communication specialist, the audience for scientists, but now a lot of what you're doing at the Broad is it's more community engagement and things like that. Can you just kind of break down what that means to you and like what your day-to-day looks like?
Yeah, my current job title is I'm the Associate Director for Scientific Public Engagement and Broad Discovery Center. And that is, I didn't like start with this role at the Broad. When I started in 2018, my job description as a science communications officer at that time was I was essentially like a lot of my work was as a science writer. I would interview mm-hmm. scientists and collaborators at Broad and write about their research in news stories. I would interview scientists, write profiles on them, and write blogs. I would partner with our social media manager on like social media campaigns, featuring Broad science and scientists. The audience here is like kind of large to say. Like I would say like scientists are still a subsection of the audience, but it's larger because like we always write, I mean, the Office of Communications and everything we put out there, we write in an accessible way to make sure that those who are not from a specific like, you know, genomics research or chemistry mm-hmm. or any of the specialized field can still understand. Like, so somebody could be like from math or I don't know, software engineering and is kind of familiarizing themselves with biology research for this first time, still they are able to understand. Patients, journalists, you know, school students, educators, non-scientists in general. Like, so we cast a wide net. So kind of, I would say that's how I think of the audience. Around 2019, I became a part of like a team that was starting to plan out a museum in our institute in the lobby of our Main Street building in Kendall Square, Cambridge. So our vision is to convert the lobby into a public science museum, or what we are calling it, the Broad Discovery Center. So my role in the Broad Discovery Center team kind of started more as a science content developer. Like I was working with other science writers to like kind of think of, okay, what are the stories we are going to tell? How will we write the stories? How will we feature the best science stories in this space? However, in earlier this year, I kind of transitioned to the role of kind of product owner or like project lead, where I was leading this group of like content developers, architects, and consultants that are planning to build this space, like build a museum space. So I would say that my role transitioned from being like an individual, like, you know, content developer to like someone who's now managing the project and overseeing a lot of like day-to-day priorities or looking at mm-hmm. like looking forward into what are the plans we need to have in place for not just like the content and the design and the interactives that'll go into the space, but what are the plans that we need to have around like the operations of the place when it launches, or all the stakeholders we need to be in touch with. And a large focus in my role as you know, I'm also like my other job profile at Broad is scientific public engagement. A lot of my work also focuses on building community relations with like the, you know, public school system or with like local community organizations, youth organizations, other nonprofits that are kind of dedicated to like STEM engagement and STEM education. Mm. So I also like try to, you know, build partnerships, like reach out to them, keep them updated on our plans. I build relationships and, you know, collaborations with directors at other museums, like the MIT Museum or the Massachusetts General Hospital Museum. And I like, you know, I'm also like trying to see where are some synergies, like once this place is live later in 2022, you know, how can we build some like collaborative, like programming, like which has our community's needs represented in those programming? How can we build tours? How can we like have the different museums and the different like places to see around Kendall Square all a part of like just a cohesive plan? So a lot of my efforts are also like making sure that, you know, I'm representing Broad Institute in those conversations, in those community spaces, and these committees and like groups. So that's how I like to define my current role. But it didn't start out like this. Like I said, I started out as a science writer, science content developer, and I kind of eventually, with a focus on public engagement, and I eventually transitioned to this role where I'm looking at this at the Broad Discovery Center, not from just content, but also from all these other areas, that all these pieces that need to fit together leading up to when it launches and also beyond its launch.
It's your job is so cool. So, you know, before we get to one of our favorite pieces, which is our rapid fire round, we do have a couple more questions. And, you know, that's, you've touched a lot on your work out within the Broad and what you've done in your career, but you spoke to us a little bit about how even your science communication background has helped with playing an important role in your personal circles, especially during the last couple of years. Can you speak a little bit more about like your experience communicating with family and friends during this time?
Yeah, thank you for the question. That's actually like a really personal side of things, and I haven't shared as much publicly about this, though some of the communication I did was pretty public. Sometime during the first year of the pandemic, around middle of 2020, I started seeing like this just so much misinformation, you know, being forwarded on WhatsApp. I was seeing it on my Facebook feed, and it was very frustrating. And I, at that time, realized that, you know, looking at kind of like my community here in the U.S. and a lot of my friends and family and extended circles back in India, like, I'm not the only scientist in my community here in the U.S., which is quite, you know, predominantly it is a lot of other scientists, because I came here and went to grad school, and that's how my friend circle started. But if you think about it, like, you know, my other network, it's like I'm kind of the only scientist, or like we don't have physicians in our family, like, you know, so I am the person, go-to person, like where a lot of my family members reach out to for any science-related, health-related, disease-related questions. So of course, like I understand and I completely, completely agree that, you know, as a science communicator, like, you know, I always, like during the pandemic, I stayed in my lane. Like my specialization is not infectious disease, not epidemiology, or like not even like I don't have a training in public health. So I don't have a place to comment or like have opinion. I always stuck to like credible information, which physicians, CDC, or like, you know, regulatory agencies, or even trusted sources or published research was sharing out there. My job at that time was basically giving all my other networks access to that information in a very simple, accessible, and short format. I realized my two worlds were so different. Like here I am, like, you know, at Broad, like surrounded by a just amazing scientific community. We were having town halls where physicians were coming and giving like really great pieces of information. But this is also the audience that is used to reading like 5 journal articles a day or a long form Atlantic piece in like 30 minutes. Like, so that's not the audience that, you know, if somebody says like, oh, what's the current scenario of this variant? Like, I can't just forward a New York Times article and assume they're going to do the reading and that's it. Like, so I started realizing that there is a barrier to access to information. You know, I was constantly at the forefront of having immediate access from the morning I wake up to like going to bed. Like I have access to credible information all through my feed. through my workplace, through all the stuff I'm reading. But that was a different reality for family and friends. And this, that is the moment where I kind of figured out that I need to do something about getting access, bringing access to information and like vetted, credible information with sources. So I started like, you know, I used platforms where all like, you know, I have around 1,000 people who are in my friends network on Facebook. I have people who follow me on Instagram. I have a lot of family like in India and other countries outside of US. WhatsApp is the platform which people commonly use, not just for messaging, but daily, like status sharing, like what you do for Instagram or Facebook. People use that for WhatsApp as well. So I started creating bite-sized, credible information. Like every day after work, I would dedicate an hour just spending on Canva. Like, you know, it's easy to design platform. And I would like just go in, create like really short infographics and immediately like share it with family, share it on Facebook, share it like every place I can think of with that would get into like, you know, if something is getting forwarded through like the various chains on WhatsApp and all of these on Facebook, let it be credible information. And then I started seeing a lot of like, not just my friends in India, but a lot of my friends who I didn't think of even in the US started reaching out to me saying they found their information, they found a lot of my information so helpful that they started reaching out to me with questions. And of course, like I am not an expert, I will not be able to like comment, but I would like try to research and find them some credible articles. Like, I think I read this, so maybe read this, or let me hear, let me ask, reach out to another colleague and find out. So I kind of landed up becoming like a just the go-to science information person for a lot of these networks. Like one of my friends reached out to me and said like her parents did not want to get vaccinated, and she just convinced them to follow us. She just convinced them to follow me on Instagram so that they can just like, you know, they know me, they've known me since the time I was in grad school, and they just, at least there's this element of trust that they could have that I am not like, you know, I can be someone who's trusted and I'm sharing credible information. So that was really fulfilling. But I know with vaccine hesitancy, like a lot of it was, or even with following COVID rules, it was just public health messaging has been easy to understand and follow for some groups of people, but not for everyone. Mm-hmm. So a lot of it all through like the last 2 years have been just kind of like speaking to family, like explaining to them why this matters. What's the point of getting vaccinated? Like, so it's like, you know, patience, empathy, meeting your audience where they are, you know, conversational style of communication, and not like everybody does not have the same level of like reading or processing information or critical thinking, and kind of understanding those was, I feel, some of the lessons I learned. And it is okay, like, you know, if people are nervous of processing so much information, and if some of my family and friends are reaching out to me to ask, I'm okay with doing the research for them and figuring it out and like giving them credible information in an accessible way. And if that's the role I can play as just somebody between, somebody in between, you know, as just as their science friend or science family friend, I'm okay with that kind of identity in my personal network.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's such a good story and something that I can totally relate to. Like, it was that realization, I think, you know, maybe actually when the pandemic first started, that realization that like we were so privileged to have access to this information, but not just have access to it, but actually understand it and be able to digest it and, you know that it was changing constantly and not be frustrated by it, to just know that that was part of the scientific process. So I totally relate to that. And I really appreciate, you know, you setting such an example.
Totally.
All right. Well, I think it's that time for the rapid fire round.
Let's do it. So we just have a few questions for you that we try to answer rapidly. Doesn't always happen as rapid as we hoped, but why don't we just jump into it? So what was your first job?
When I was in college during my undergrad, I used to tutor middle school and high school kids in my neighborhood. So, you know, just through family connections, like, will you please like tutor my kid for science and math? So I used to teach science and math.
Not even like you worked in an ice cream shop or like something, lifeguard, anything.
Everything is very in line with the mission.
Yes.
Mission aligned.
And what is your favorite television show?
Oh my God. You know, there are so many. Like, I unwind every day with a good glass of wine or tea and TV. I think, like, there are different genres, right? Like, I would say in comedy, I recently finished watching Brooklyn Nine-Nine, and I really enjoyed it.
Oh, yeah. If you could pick any company, okay, other than The Broad, where you currently work, to lead efforts in SciComm or science communication,
or which would you engagement.
Pick? Or public engagement, what would you pick?
I don't think I will be leaving Broad for this organization, but if you think about it, like, my skill sets, my scientific training, and what I really do for my full-time job now would have served the Environmental Protection Agency, or the US EPA, as you call it, really well. Some of my really close friends, like, they went on to work after, you know, PhD, they went on to work for the EPA. I, not being a US citizen, was anyways not eligible to apply for those jobs. But if there was a place I could have put my toxicology, environmental toxicology, and public engagement with science both at work for the betterment of the community, it would have been the EPA.
And I will add to that, if there's a place that needs more science communication specialists, it would be the EPA, but, you know.
And what is one of your favorite hobbies?
I love cooking. I'm a big foodie, so, but just kind of learning to cook on my own. And that's also like a relationship, you know, I maintain with, like, a connection and relationship with my motherland. Like, you know, I miss India and I miss my roots. Food brings in a tremendous amount of familiarity and, like, community feeling. And I just am so passionate about, like, you know, learning how to cook new dishes. But it's definitely very focused on the kind of food I grew up with, or the memories I have with, you know, certain types of food. I occasionally, like, post. I have a separate, this is not my science Instagram, I have a separate food Instagram called the Food Communicator, where I often, like, post photos of my food.
Or, but we'll tag it.
Yeah. And I also like supporting, like, local restaurants, you know, like, living in the Cambridge, Boston area has been such a blessing. And during the pandemic and even beyond, like, I feel like supporting local restaurants, especially from those from different, you know, underserved communities, I always, like, am advocating for that.
If you could travel anywhere right now, where would it be?
I would go to India. If I could just travel immediately. I haven't seen my family in more than 2 years now. I am just waiting to book a ticket and, like, just go see my family. And I think I cannot plan or think of traveling anywhere. Yeah. That's, like, on top of my mind. It's been on top of my mind for the last 2 years.
I hope that for you too.
And the last question we have for you, that we ask all of our guests, any charities, pieces of legislation, you know, really anything you would want to promote or talk about that you're really passionate about, that you want others to learn more about?
Yeah, I think I'd like to give a shout out to the organization I volunteer with, Asian Women for Health. And I think it's an incredible organization, very mission-driven. It's an organization that is run by, you know, the API community. It's for, like, women from the API community, for educating, advocating, and empowering women about health. There's a lot of health disparities associated with Asian communities, and the idea is to create more access, create more culturally sensitive care opportunities, and also, like, making sure that there are partnerships that are happening in the greater Boston area that understand, like, this is a hub for biomedical care. This is a hub for biomedical research. And if any organizations are looking forward to like partner or give a seat at the table, like, you know, for an Asian women's health organization, that please reach out to Asian Women for Health. Mm. I'm so proud that I serve on the board of this organization. So that's my shout out. Like, check out the website, Asian Women for Health, or follow them on social media. They've been doing incredible work during the pandemic to also raise awareness about, like, you know, COVID-19 testing in the greater Boston area, and, you know, just also addressing vaccine hesitancy in the Asian community. So that's my shout out for a local Boston area nonprofit. If you work for an organization that has a matching gifts program or a matching donation program, please consider Asian Women for Health. It's a really small scale nonprofit. So, you know, being able to like benefit from a program like that is going to be huge to run like community centered peer to peer programs that they run for Asian women.
Awesome. Well, we will be sure to tag them. And just thank you for sharing your story with us. We have learned so much about science communication and so much of what that means. And thank you for joining us, having a glass of wine and, you know, enjoying happy hour together. This was awesome.
It was great.
If you would like to nominate someone to be on our podcast, please reach out to us via Twitter or Instagram at RoseanneDNA or our website, roseannedna.com.
And in the meantime, be well, be empowered, and cheers. Yes.